Nostalgia is often the merchandise of how we live, our very existence, isn't it? Yesterday in the Campbell home, the internet server had gone down and we were trying to figure out how to get it back on. And I was reminding myself of how we had named our home hub Kilbride, which is where we were living before we left to come here. And I remember thinking, you know, just over a year ago, it was important to have those names in our new place so that we wouldn't forget about them. Another interesting thing, as I was going through the list of names on the internet servers, there was another interesting name as you went down the neighborhood servers. One was Falcha, which is Irish for welcome. And I remember last year being so curious about who in our neighborhood would name their server Falcha. And it turns out our next door neighbor is Irish. God has a plan. But he was doing exactly the same thing as we were doing, holding on to something from home. That's nostalgia. So you can imagine just how intense or more intense that feeling of nostalgia would be for these people who'd been carried into exile. Jeremiah's people had been forcibly removed from their home. They had traveled over 700 miles into Babylon, this different culture, different language. All that was familiar was gone. There must have been loads of questions. What's going to happen to us now? What's going to happen to our king? What's going to happen to David's line? What's going to happen to our borders? What's going to happen to Jerusalem and the temple? And encasing all these uncertainties was this one word that crops up again and again in the book of Jeremiah. It's the word shalom. Now, Perry Yoder talks about how there's different shades of meaning to this one word, shalom. There's the material shalom, looking after your physical needs. In Africa, whenever you go to someone's house, they offer you food because they're looking after your physical well-being. That's so important before you get to the purpose of the visit. It's about making sure you're physically all right. But then there's the shalom of social relationships, making sure you have right relationships with each other. And then there's the moral, ethical shalom. Is there justice and peace at work? Is there a love of truth here? Is there integrity? And all these different ideas are encapsulated in this one word, shalom. When Joseph was asked by his dad to go out and check on all his other brothers who were out watching the sheep, he was asked, go and check on their shalom. And shalom is simply asking the question, is everything the way it's supposed to be? Is everything all right? And so this idea of shalom kept cropping up in the book of Jeremiah. But the problem was, it was being used not by Jeremiah, but by the false prophets. They kept saying, shalom will come, shalom will come. And Jeremiah was saying, no, the wound of our people is so deep, shalom is not going to paper over this problem. There's no shalom. You might say shalom, shalom, but there's no shalom. But these prophets kept reducing the word shalom as this kind of false comfort. They said, the sword is not going to come, but the sword did come. These prophets said, famine's not going to come, but famine did come. The prophets said, this exile, it's only going to be short, but we know the exile lasted a long time. And so they had cheapened this word shalom. It was a cheap shalom that was being talked about in Jeremiah, was contaminated. A bit like violins that were playing on the sinking ship Titanic. The music had gone. What was the good of the music of this shalom in Jeremiah? This word shalom has an adjective attached to it, which is interesting. It talks about the uncut stones that you place and dedicate on an altar. And these stones were used to help measure out weights accurately. They were uncut, uncontaminated. And so everything else was measured to its correct size. But you see, the problem was the people of Judah had cut the stones and reduced them to cheat themselves and to cheat others. So there was a deep problem with this word shalom. And added to this, there was now two groups of people. There were the people at home and there were the people in exile. And you could see there was this growing distance and tension within the people of God themselves. There were all the elite who'd been carried off. All the officials, all the artisans, all the skillful people were now in Babylon. And the powerful had been rendered powerless, and they were slipping towards despair. But then there were those who were left in Jerusalem, along with Jeremiah. They were the runts of the litter that Babylon didn't want, but yet they were still in the holy city, and they were probably thinking to themselves, well, is it possible that we are the ones to carry on the chosen race? So if the powerful were teetering towards despair, the powerless were teetering towards triumphalism. And all the while, the false prophets were agitating both with this word, shalom. Shalom will come, shalom will come. The prophets thought, if we just say this word often enough, it will come into existence. These people have a form of religion, and yet it denies its power. But you see, God was on the move in an entirely different way. God was in Babylon. Before we reach this chapter 29, there's an interesting phrase where God says, Nebuchadnezzar will be my servant. I'm going to even give him control over the wild animals. I find that interesting to imagine how a king will be in control of the wild beasts of the field. And this language is interesting because the only time God has talked about his servants, it's people like Moses and King David who were the chosen servants. But now Nebuchadnezzar is going to be the servant too. And when did we last hear language about God putting a human in charge of animals? Well, that's the language of Eden, isn't it? A reconstruction of original intentions is happening in Babylon. Now, that's interesting. God was letting Nebuchadnezzar be this new Adam figure, that even Judah's enemies were under Nebuchadnezzar's control. And you see, what was happening here was that Judah had this idea of God that was too small. They had this container for their religion that was perfectly safe and perfectly credible, but it was too small for this God. And as the people of God were shrinking down, this view of Yahweh was enlarging. The people were seeing that the superpower, this empire that had taken them captive, was being controlled by their God. And so by the time you get to Jeremiah 29, and this letter that Jeremiah writes from Jerusalem to Babylon, it says it's put in the hands of those who have survived, the surviving elders in exile. And even though it says in verse 1, that these people had been carried by Nebuchadnezzar into exile, By the time we get to read the body of the letter, it says, this is what the Lord of hosts says to all those I carried into exile. So you see, at the level of human history, yes, it was Nebuchadnezzar who had made all the orders, but at the prophetic level, it was God orchestrating it all. It was God who had carried his people there. I know many of you know the family, the Sarwar family, Eric Sarwar and Shemaila and their children. Eric is this Presbyterian pastor from Pakistan who's now living in California doing doctoral studies. And Eric has been a friend of ours for a long time. He's visited us in Ireland and made some visits there. But a few years ago, we met up at Calvin Worship Symposium. We're both presenting a seminar together, and I'd just arrived from Ireland, and I met up with Eric, who'd arrived from Pakistan. But the moment I saw Eric, I knew something was different, because his face was swollen, it had been badly bruised, and he looked very fragile, and it turned out that he'd been badly beaten up before he left Pakistan, and he had to go into hiding. And he'd smuggled himself out of Pakistan. And so as we talked, it emerged that to go back home to his family was going to be very difficult. How could he return? And returning was not going to be an option. And this started, as you know, this long process of finding help for Eric and for his family too. But a couple of days later, we were in the worship symposium together. A couple of days later, we were sitting having breakfast, and Eric was sharing with me the psalm that he had just written or read, Psalm 60, where it says, Moab is my washbasin. And he said to me, you know, Karen, that's the word I needed from God. Moab is my washbasin. And I thought, well, what's that mean? Help me out here, Eric. And he said, well, Moab was an enemy of God's people. And yet God was saying, but Moab is my washbasin. I wash my feet here. Moab is under my control. I use this nation as my washbasin. And Eric says, that says to me, God is under control, all full control of my situation. God is the one in charge. I'll never forget that from Eric Sarwar, Psalm 60, Moab is my washbasin. And that gave Eric the peace to keep moving forwards and not look back. God is the one who carried his people into exile. And this was a hard word for them, because it would have been easy to say, well, it's the Babylonians' fault. How dare they oppress us? And they could have lived in that place of despair. Or it would have been easy simply to blame God and say, why have you done this to us? God has deserted us. He's not part of us any longer. But God was saying, I want you to realize I did this to you and I'm here with you, so that you can begin to see the result of your own actions and turn back to me. And what God was doing here was trying to get his people to shift their perception, to see God hadn't left them, but God was there. Not to wistfully stagnate in the hope that things were going to get better, and not to live in the nostalgia of the past where things were better, but it was a calling to live in the present. And so in this letter, once Jeremiah gets the people to realize that God has brought them here, he then begins to restore this image of shalom for them, to rehabilitate the image of shalom. Life that's fully integrated under the sovereignty of God. And he gives them four directions. He says, settle down and build your houses. Plant your gardens. Get married and then seek the shalom of this city. Now, when you think about the refugees today, the 70 million refugees and the conditions that they live in those makeshift tents, and the food that they eat, which is given to them by the UNHCR, that's not the picture that Jeremiah was trying to give the exiles and refugees here. But Jeremiah was telling them, don't live like refugees, live like residents. Even though they wouldn't have brought any capital with them into the city of Babylon, he was calling them, invest in this city. And this was a hard word when you think of all the adjectives that are attached to this city, Babylon. Investing means having a relationship that's more than just this polite sectarian difference. It means taking the risk of developing intimacy with strangers. It also meant giving up the dream that they'd be back home in a couple of years' time. Jeremiah was saying, your children are going to be born here, and your children's children are going to be born here. And the language and accent they might have might be so different from the one you have. Your children are going to thrive here. And do you feel the echoes of Egypt happening all over again, where the Hebrew slaves under captivity multiplied and were prosperous? And that's telling us something, that it's in this place God's going to do it all over again, that this new Exodus is still on the move, that there's a power here at work that's so much more powerful than the captors. There's a building, there's a planting, there's a marrying, there's a having children. This is the language of Eden. It's the language of blessing. It's echoes from Genesis. It's echoes of Father Abraham. Because God was saying, I'm giving you a new start. But this blessing is not going to come because you're entitled to it. But it's coming because I love you. It's a gift. And whilst shalom was the task they had to employ in this city, shalom was the gift. To learn again what it means to be in fellowship with God, to learn that connection, that dependence on God, that God can do it all over again. And by praying this shalom into the city, the people were going to realize that the food on their table was a gift from God. They were going to realize that the land they walked on was a gift from God. They were going to realize that from the moment they waked up and breathed in that air, it was all a gift from God. And all this was going to decenter their sense of entitlement and reawaken them to the language that God is good. And God has good, amazing grace to learn to pray and ask God, do it again, Lord, make something out of our nothingness. Do the impossible. That was their calling, from refugees to residents, from mourners to missionaries, from being victims to being visionaries, to see God do it again. You see, there's this superficial idea of shalom we all have that's to do with consensus. There's a group over here who have a different worldview, so let's just agree to disagree. You live in your small corner of the world, and I will live in mine. But that's the language of privilege, the language of entitlement. Those who have the resources to live within their silos. But it takes the oppressed and the marginalized to reawaken us to see God's grace, that God's in charge of everything. A couple of weeks ago, our family watched that beautiful movie called 42, the story of Jackie Robinson and how he got in to playing Major League Baseball. He was the first African-American to do so. And the movie charts his story, the difficult road he had to finding his place on the team. And there were repercussions for his teammates too. There was a scene where one of his teammates comes into the coach's head office and gives him a letter because he's from Alabama and the team is about to go and play in Alabama. And he says to the head coach, "Do you see the letters I'm getting from home, the hate mail about being part of this team? I just love baseball. I'm here for the love of the game. I didn't sign up for this, all this hate mail, and I don't think I can take it anymore." And the coach simply walks over to the filing cabinet, pulls open a drawer, and begins to lift out folders and folders and folders, and opens them out for the teammate to see the hate mail that Jackie Robinson has received, the folders of hate mail. And the coach says, "Jackie loves baseball too. He wants to play baseball too, but we're all a part of this now." And quickly the baseball player realizes he has to let go of his own sense of entitlement to work for this bigger picture. And that's what's happening to the people of God. They're letting go of that old, tired sense of entitlement. They're cut adrift from it so that they can realize this bigger picture of shalom blessing, where all things are made new. God was bringing his own people to their knees, making them the voice of the marginalized, so that in doing so, they can rediscover prayer, prayer that connects them to the God of heaven and earth, prayer that connects them to the true shalom, the deep shalom that's woven into the very fabric of our existence. Prayer was getting them in touch with the shalom music that enables them to live in harmony with God and with the material world and the relational world. And in a place where Nebuchadnezzar would become God's Adam, the people were going to realize, what is it going to take to topple over this Adam? What kind of new Adam do we need, who's more powerful to save than the original Adam is to destroy? And so I think of another time under a different empire, the Roman Empire, where they were moving people around, demanding that people should be on the move. When a priest was in his temple performing his sacred duties with incense all smelling around them, and there was this holy hush, and the angel came to tell him he was going to have a child, and he was the one that doubted. But then the story goes to that little teenage girl, Mary, who's told, "You're not married, but you'll have a child. The impossible is going to happen to you." And she simply accepts it and says, "Yes, that word is right for me." And Mary is pushed around by this empire to suit their convenience. And despite the inhospitable Bethlehem, despite the emperor's senses, it all works under God's command, and Mary steps into that role of being Jesus' mother without any preconditions. Because you see, it's not the priest in the temple that day who witnessed the magnitude of God. It was that young girl who was ready to say, "Yes, God, I'm on the move with you." And to see Jesus, that exile who came down from heaven to give up everything so that we could have everything, that's Mary. And that's the essence of our gospel. We're not of this world. This world is not our home. We're in exile here. But as long as we live here, we're called to seek the shalom of this earth, because our salvation is intrinsically bound up with the salvation of the place and the people among whom we are. We do not make forays into the world to snatch out a few refugees and set camp in the world, but we love it. We're residents here. We embrace it. And through that, we get connected to the God of hope again. And that's why this passage leads us directly to one of the most quoted verses in the Bible. I know the plans I have for you, plans for your shalom, not for your harm, plans to give you hope and a future. Seek this shalom, because this shalom is your hope. So in closing, do you have that shalom? Or are you like the false prophets, too desperate to make things good and make things happen? You've forgotten what this deep shalom is. Maybe you're living in Grand Rapids because it's the place of second choice. It's not where you want it to be. Maybe your family life is the family life of second choice. It's not what you want it to be, and you have this nostalgia going on where you're blaming God or blaming the people around you. Well, maybe today is this invitation, this opportunity to see God is on the move. God is bigger. God is magnified, the way Mary talks about. God is the one who gives shalom as the gift to us. Listen to how Eugene Peterson describes the transformation of the people who went into Babylon to seek their shalom. He says, jarred out of their everydayness by the exile, they embarked on the search. They settled down to find out what it meant to be God's people in the place they did not want to be, in Babylon. But the result was that this became the most creative period in the entire sweep of Hebrew history. They didn't lose their identity. They discovered it. They learned how to pray in deeper, more life-changing ways than ever. They wrote, they copied, they pondered the vast revelation that had come down to them from Moses and the prophets, and they came to realize the richness of their scriptures. They found God was not dependent on a place, that he was not tied to familiar surroundings. They lost everything they thought was important and found what was important. They found God. The exile was the crucible of their faith. They were pushed to the edge of their existence where they thought they were hanging on by the skin of their teeth, and they found that, in fact, they'd been pushed to the center where God was. They experienced not bare survival, but abundant life. So in this second choice world, what is your merchandise? Is it nostalgia, looking back? Is it escapism, looking forward? Or is it shalom? Some lead to death, but shalom leads to life. What would happen if you began to persistently pray your best prayers for this place, for this city? Maybe we'd rediscover again who we are. Maybe we'd rediscover our fresh calling that's true to our identity, not just for ourselves, but for this entire world. Shalom. It's the place where we're called to live. So may God help us live our shalom lives and pray our best prayers and see transformation in this time and in this place. Amen.